I just pitched an idea to Brad. I got to share this with you. I didn't hit record in time, but I pitched an idea to Brad about how to post some images. And Brad goes like this. If this was his actual voice, he goes, "Oh yeah, that's an interesting idea. That's really interesting." And I immediately know in friendship, like, nope, he hates that idea. He went up two octaves, and he was pleasant about it. "Oh yeah, that's a real good idea you got there. That's a real winner."
Yeah, you know that I hate an idea when I immediately turn into Barney Fife. that's pretty good. I think you can actually do that.
Wait, why does your Barney Fife sound like the old prospector from Blazing Saddles?
He's speaking authentic frontier gibberish.
"I said the shiver with the hammer, shiver, hammer." That's one of Mel Brooks' best jokes, is that whole character up on the roof, like, trying to warn everybody.
Oh God, yes. I was watching Spaceballs. I had an entire 4 days. Carolyn took the kids to visit some friends down the shore. And I took the time to catch up because I fell way behind this month. So I took the time to be a bachelor and just do nothing but sit and draw. And I was watching, as I was inking, Spaceballs. And do you know who's in the Spaceballs that I've become a big fan of through One Day at a Time and before that, Groundhog Day?
Tobolowsky?
He's in Spaceballs! I never knew this!
Is that real? I don't remember what scene he's in.
Okay, so there's a scene where... Do you remember the scene where they capture the heroes and it turns out that they've really captured their stunt doubles?
And
princess character has a short guy with a beard and all this stuff. Well, it's Tobolowsky that realizes it. He comes in and he's the one that realizes... He's one of the Spaceball commander type guys. And he realizes that they've captured the stunt doubles.
He is a delightful human being, Brad. You would like him very much.
I really want to meet him someday. Because, like, probably like half of America, the time I really recognized Steven was in Groundhog Day, right? The whole needle-nose Ned.
Yeah. It was such a starring performance from him. Like, it literally was a scene stealer.
Yeah.
Ned Ryerson? You know, that whole
needle-nose
thing was great.
Needle-nose Ned?
Yeah.
Ned the Head? And then what happens is he's got a wonderful face and a wonderful delivery, and then all of a sudden, like a good character actor, you see him pop up everywhere. And I thought I had caught him in all of his appearances. And then all of a sudden, Spaceballs is on and I hear that voice. And I'm like, I know that voice. And he's got this, he's got a helmet on, but along the sides, he's got this full curly hair. And it's like, oh my God, you block the hair out. And now I can see who it is, you know? It's really wonderful.
Yeah. Isn't that funny, though, how some people, and actors, this is always especially true, they sometimes, and maybe this is true for cartoonists, too, we could actually roll this into the show.
Yeah.
Some people don't, quote, come into their look until their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And kind of interesting from an artistic's perspective that Tobolowsky kind of found his look when he hit, you know, 45 to 55, somewhere in that range. And then he's had a great actor's look since then. But that could also be true of artists and their careers. You know what I mean? Like, maybe, Brad, you didn't find your look, I could say this as a friend, until probably your early 40s.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And what, I mean, we've talked about finding your style. The way I always say it to my students is finding your drawing style is not something you drive towards. It's something you see in your rearview mirror, you know?
Yeah. No, that's a good point.
That really is. I look at my stuff now, even more so. Like, I've tried to draw Greystone Inn the way I used to draw it. I just can't. And if I come close to it, it's like, no, I don't want to do that again. I don't want to go back there. It was a long time of refining, drawing over and over and over, 10,000 hours and all of those platitudes. But it took a long time. But gee whiz, when I draw a character now, I really feel proud of it. Whereas before it was like, nah, I'm getting there, you know? Did you find that to be the case?
I did. And actually, the way you described that right there, I want to raise a theoretical question, and we haven't asked this before of each other, so because it's kind of a BS question. But let me ask you this. If a human lifespan could be extended two or three times, if Brad Geiger could live 300 years, do you think you would have entire waves of styles that would come and go every 20, 30 years. Like you have like, oh yeah, that was my superhero style.
Yeah, because and you get bored of drawing a certain way, and not even bored, but your aesthetic develops, your hand-eye coordination gets better, your ability to do things. You pick up through all kinds of happy accidents, little shortcuts and rules of thumb that you apply when you're in a certain situation. So yeah, I think you'd go through waves. That's actually a really beautiful thought. I picture myself somewhere around 294 years old drawing almost as well as John Buscema.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Brad Geiger. No, but I mean, like, maybe the sign, Brad, of artistic genius, of which I am 100% not putting us in that category, but maybe the sign of artistic genius is the ability to cycle through styles much quicker than the average artist, you know?
Yeah.
There's a reason why, like, Matisse could go through 5 different phases in his life, or Picasso 10 different phases in his career, where their style is remarkably and drastically different. And maybe it's just because they're like, all right, I did that. I conquered that one. Now I'm moving on to the next style. You know, that kind of thing.
And they constantly push. They constantly try to get to the next level. And it's not somebody else maybe pushing them, but it's this inner drive that's saying, no, I got to keep going. I want to do the next thing.
Right. And in cartooning, one of the best examples, and rest his soul, Richard Thompson, I think, was amazing at that, where he would really conquer a certain style of like Italian gold applique, and then he would move on to something else, and he would figure that out, and we'd work on chalk, and then he would work on, pastels and work on it. He was amazing with that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's why when I see people like our friends, Kevin McShane over there at BuzzFeed, who can draw in so many different styles, like dead on, like he did that one thing where he drew his self-portrait in a bunch of different styles.
Right.
My phrase for that is I can barely draw like Brad Geiger. How do you expect me to draw like other people? I've tried in different cases to evoke someone else's style, even to the point where I brought like a Bruce Tim illustration in and traced it. And my tracing still didn't look anything like Bruce Tim. I marvel at people who can pull off different styles. Yeah. I'm so locked into my own way of thinking about form and image that I have a hard time thinking like other people.
Well, I have to say that I think even if you considered yourself a failure at trying to do that Bruce Timm, I bet you that it informed your drawing in the future.
Yeah, it definitely doing that and following somebody like Alex Toth teaches you an awful lot about minimalization, really boiling down the image to the handful of lines that you need to make that work.
Right. And so, like, if you try to do McKay, if you try to do Bruce Timm, if you try to do Watterson, if you try to do Schultz, you'll just by the failing process, the stumbling process of trying to do them, you'll be like, oh, I kind of see why they did this. Or sometimes, and this is very true even with the masters for me, I go like, oh, that's a dumb way to do that. Like, but it worked for them. But I don't like drawing. I don't like the way, Harriman has a very specific drawing style that almost requires a mania of line. Dashes, right?
Yeah.
Like literally the word mania, because it's like, I got to draw these lines, got to draw these lines, look at all these lines. But when it's done, a crazy cat looks amazing, but you kind of have to be manic to draw that way, you know?
Yeah, you've got to have that detritus all over the page.
Oh, detritus. Detritus. This is me and Apropos. Brad, what are we doing? Brad, the English language is not succumbing to our will here, Brad. Detritus. Anyway, on that note of Brad's detritus, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, directly from Detritus, Michigan, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil, Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's hour of comics advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, Let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. And as you remember, everybody, for the next 7 weeks, Comic Lab is sponsored in part by the wonderful folks over at Wacom. And Brad, one of the things I wanted to talk to you, because it's kind of fun. Do you remember the reason why I, who love original art and love drawing ink on paper, why I switched Drive over to digital so I could draw it on a Wacom? Do you remember that?
Why you switched? No, I don't remember why you
switched. Did we ever have this conversation?
I don't know that we have.
Oh, okay. So let me.
You seem to think I'm keeping a book of all of your decisions. I only follow your pronunciations. I'm not writing your diary for you.
Oh, so Brad, I. You know what? My mistake was I thought that as a friend you cared about me. That's where I went wrong. That was my mistake.
I thought we crossed that bridge a long time ago. I'm self-involved, not Kellett involved.
I'm still keeping that lamp lit near the shore, hoping you come into the bay, Brad. That's what I'm. that was much more poetical than I set out to be. But
yeah.
All right, anyway.
I love poetical things.
All right, so let me tell you. So I'm drawing Drive, and I did the first 30 or so ink on paper, and lovely. I still have about 8 of them. They're lovely. It was fun to do, but every time I had to do a star field or a ship, like going into a faster than light speed on ink. Brad, this is not an exaggeration when I would say that particular page of Drive would take me 16 to 20 hours because drawing a star field with a warping ship flying through it at FTL speeds, and I was like, this is maddening. I can't do this. I have to switch to digital. So at some point, kind of like you making the switch to the manga Studio Pro there.
Yeah. Clip Studio Paint.
Paint, there we go. I'm sorry, yes. Kind of like when you made the decision to switch to Clip Studio Paint. With me switching from analog to digital, I finally just pulled the trigger and said, next week, I'm drawing Drive digitally. I don't care how long it takes, because I have to do something else with these star fields. This is ridiculous. So literally, it was star fields that made me go digital onto the Wacom with Drive. It was literally just not wanting to go dot, 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 with a little white opaque. Yeah, exactly. Tack, tack, tack. Just individually drawing stars of a nebula where you're like, what am I doing with my life?
Yeah. Yeah. And really, I mean, we've had this conversation before. When you finally decide to go to Clip Studio Paint from Photoshop, you're going to have to do the same thing. You're just going to have to decide today's Friday and Monday's comic is going to be done on CSP. And you just got to throw the switch and jump. If you give yourself an out, you'll never do it.
You're right. No, you're right. You're right.
But one thing about all of that is Wacom made it easy for you to go to that new series of drawing steps, right? In other words, once you started working on it, it was like, oh yeah, I see how this works. There's a very little learning curve to moving to a Cintiq. And I know that because my own particular story was a little bit different than yours.
Okay.
Me, I was a Bristol board guy for, oh God, going on 15 years or so. And before that, before I really started working professionally. But for me, it was this. I was buying Bristol board, and the quality of Bristol board was varying so greatly, I couldn't get good Bristol board anymore.
Oh, yes. I know of what you speak. There was a couple years there where, frankly, I think it was a cost-cutting thing. They were changing the quality of their paper, and people would complain, and then they'd switch back, but it was not back to the original. And so the spread of the ink on the paper was changing over like a 3-year period. I remember I had a whole conversation with Tom Richmond of Mad Magazine about that, how they were changing the quality of the Bristol board. Yeah, keep going.
And some of it was spongy, and some of it was absorbent, and some of it was plasticky. It was the worst.
It's like your dating career. Yeah. It was,
You ain't a kidding. And I realized, if this is the way it's going to be. And by the way, side note, Bristol board is not cheap. It's expensive to buy Bristol board. And I was sinking all that money in, and I had this Cintiq sitting there on my desk, and I was like, that's it. I'm making the change. And that was one case, unlike the switch from Photoshop to CSP, that just went like a dream, because a Cintiq handles so much like a real a drawing experience. It doesn't mimic it. It really is a real drawing experience. You don't have space between your nib and the glass and the image. It's a live drawing experience, and I took to that like a fish to water. And once I realized how not only easy it was to draw on a Cintiq, but how efficient it was, and the fact that I was getting really good results, and now start to pile on all of those things you can do digitally that is harder to do analog, like those star fields and perspective and all like that.
Yeah.
I never turned back. And it was because it was so easy to jump into that Cintiq.
Well, you know what's we don't need to go forever about this, but I wanted to share one last thing, which is that drawing digitally for Drive has actually informed how I draw analog for Sheldon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's certain techniques that once you learn it digitally, you're like, oh, I could now apply this. Like, I know if you take away the layers, take away the light, take away the digital process, there's a way I could reverse engineer a certain layering approach in my analog. So it's also helped me. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I have found that it's been helpful not only in my digital work, but in my analog work, which is kind of fun.
That's pretty cool. Well, listen, Dave, what do you say we get to a few questions from our Patreon backers?
All right, Brad. So our first question this week comes in from Patreon backer June over at patreon.com/comiclab. And June writes, hello, dad and brave. I do it all the time.
Dad and brave.
Dad and brave is the weird comic strip pitch that I'm going to make to Go Comics at some point.
Yeah,
dad and brave.
That should be our bizarro podcast where everything is reversed. It'll be the dad and brave show.
The dad and brave show. Anyway, hello, Dave and Brad. How do you two... Typical day, how do you two's typical work day look like? Do you work with a regular schedule? So this is a fun question, Brad, because I actually have no idea what your day-to-day ins and outs are at the old studio there. So take me through, what is a typical day for Brad Geiger?
I wish I knew. I've been trying to answer that question ever since 2012 when I left my day job. I've been trying to answer that exact question. What should my typical day look like? And I'm going to be completely honest with you. I don't have a typical day. I wish I could tell you that I come into the studio and on Mondays I write and on Tuesdays I pencil and on Wednesdays I ink and so on and so forth. None of that happens. If I'm in a situation like I have been this summer where there's all kinds of stuff happening at home, you know, I told you a little bit about the drip that turned into a $10,000 plumbing project and we were getting our basement done at the same time. That's meant that I've had to be home kind of supervising work that's being done.
Right.
And of course, in a situation like that, I'm not really working at my best because I'm constantly answering questions and palpitating. But I don't have a typical day. The best I can tell you is this. Right now, my summer's been like this. On Mondays and Wednesdays, my intern has been coming in, so I typically need to be at the studio for that. But the last week or so, that hasn't happened because of different things. Tuesday, I record Comic Lab with Dave. That may be the only constant in my week. Because it's the same time every week. You know, we kind of arrange that. That may be my only constant on that. Thursdays and Fridays, my assistant comes in, but I've had to cancel on that because of things going on for the last 2 or 3 weeks running. And forget about, you know, having anything consistent. I write when it's time to write. I pencil and ink when it's time to do that. I may be skipping Evil Ink so I can get some more work done on Evil Ink After Dark. I may be putting a commission in priority. It's all based on what needs to be done right now. What's my priority? Going back to Jake Parker, you wake up every morning with what's the one thing that's got to be done today, and then everything follows suit after that. I don't have a typical day, and I haven't for a long, long time. It's all a whole opera of making things up as you go along. I haven't even mentioned things like taking kids to dentist appointments and getting them to school and things like this. I don't have a typical day. I wish I did. I'd love to get to the point where I have a typical day sometime, and maybe I'd be bored by it, but I have got nothing typical. What about you?
So, broad strokes, I will super agree with you and co-sign that I don't have a typical day. And frankly, that is the life that I have intentionally designed for myself. Because my creativity and yours probably springs forth from new and interesting things. Like if this was rote or repetitive, we would a little bit find our spirits dwindling away. You know, like if I wanted a rote office job that I would forget about as soon as it hits 5 o'clock, I would be in a very different career than what I'm doing right now. So one thing that Brad did not mention that I will mention is that I'm kind of always working. If there's an idea that comes to me at 1 a.m, that's just as viable a work time as an idea that comes to me at 9 a.m, you know? And so it doesn't happen every day, but there are many a nights where kids go to bed and I'm back at the drawing table, or I'm answering emails, or I'm doing whatever admin for the strips or this kind of thing. So in the thought that it's helpful, let me take June through the broader week, and I think that will at least give you the broad outlines, the major strokes of what I do on a day-to-day basis. So Beth and I both work about a 40-hour week in the studio here, and there's three work desks and then two chairs in the studio, and a little storage closet and a little work closet. Some of you have seen it where I do the podcasting from. And then a little bathroom, right? It's a little studio, cute, nice light, everything's fine. We kind of always have music going, and it's usually a mutually agreed upon playlist. We both have veto power. So if one's like, I can't take this right now, and they're like, all right, no more Mozart, whatever it is. So we kind of have a Venn diagram of music that we've shared together. And then on Monday mornings, what we do is we kind of sit down across the studio facing each other, cup of coffee, bleary-eyed, and we talk about the week ahead. And to Jake's point and your point, we talk about what has to be done that week. You know, like these are the big priorities that have to be tackled that week. And that's usually either a handwritten list or something on Wunderlist that we share of tasks back and forth that we're passing to each other. And usually the week entails one drive strip, one drive giveaway illustration for Patreon, an eBay illustration that will go up at some point during the week, and then 1 to 3 Sheldon drawings, shipping that usually has to be done on Friday, and a ton of other administration for past Kickstarters, future Kickstarters, Patreon ongoing right now, or any other income-bearing admin, like books that I sell through Amazon Advantage has a whole different thing. DVDs for Strip that I sell through Midwest Tapes or through the library service or through Canopy, right? Like there's 1,000 different income sources that I have, all of which require a unique little bit of admin, some of which bring in $100 a year, some of which bring in $5,000 a year. So it's all like varying, but each one requires a little bit of tinkering every week or two, right? So there's a bunch of admin that comes trickling in. And then reader emails. So I spend probably a day, an hour a day on reader emails and reader tweets. And I would say 1 to 2 hours on admin a day, maybe 1 hour a day on research or punching up jokes in terms of like finding supplementary or supporting information that can help me with my writing or with a joke. And then I would say about an hour or two a day writing and an hour or two a day drawing. And that's roughly what I do. And then in the course of that day, there's probably 3 good sized large coffees. And then the UPS person comes right to the window of the studio, which is great. It's so fun.
Really?
Like, they come right up to the studio window now, Brad. It's pretty fun. That's it. That's on average. I mean, you get a sense of the week there. But in general, though, I think both of our weeks absolutely change week to week. And the major projects that we're working on change every 6 months. So right now, Beth and I are putting to bed all the Kickstarter fulfillment for Pop Culture, which was the last book that I did. We're actively planning out the video and the pagination and layout for Anatomy of Authors, which is the next book that I'm going to do and be kickstarting in about 5 or 6 weeks. And then planning the fulfillment of that too. And then we're doing the very first pass draftsmanship on Drive Act 3, that book, and also on Your Life is a Line, which is the children's book that I'm going to do kickstart next year. So, but all of that requires like long-term planning and just, if nothing else, kind of stewing it over and reviewing options and all that sort of stuff. So, but it's a lovely life because the projects change every 6 months, you know, completely change. And you're onto a whole totally different thing. I mean, doing an Anatomy of Authors book, Brad, is completely different than doing a Drive book, is completely different than doing a children's book, is completely different than making Stripped. So I try to keep myself challenged and interested in new projects and new things that I do, you know?
Yeah, that's actually, I'm kind of glad you mentioned that because I feel guilty for not having more consistency, but like I said, you know, I maybe I'd get bored if it was that way. And as you're saying, you know, that you thrive on that variety, that might be kind of the best way to look at this, is that part of what we value out of this is the fact that we don't have a regular day. If we wanted a regular day, we'd maybe work at a different job. This is something that is kinetic and organic, and we're making it up as we go along.
Yeah, and I would like to hear you speak to this, Brad, because this is something that I think I quietly believe in, which is I have readers that come up to me at, like, say, the recent San Diego Comic-Con or at Emerald City Comic-Con or online or on Twitter. And they'll say, hey, I really, really, really wish you did more Sheldon and or I really, really wish you could put out 2 pages of Drive a week and forget this other stuff. And I get that and I honor that because there are some artists that, like, I love Project A, but I don't love Project B. And I just wish they would do more Project A. And why can't they see the wisdom of Project A? But here is my survival strategy and the part that I would love you to speak to, Brad, which is that I can't do Drive unless I give myself the break to work on Sheldon for a while. And I can't do Sheldon unless I give myself the break to work on Drive. And I can't do both unless I step away from them to record Comic Lab with you or to work on the new video project that I'm going to do with Fred or to work on Anatomy of Authors with Beth. Like, I have to keep it. The only way I have survived creatively for 20 years doing this is by keeping it varied, or else I would fall into a morass of sameness, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's one of the main questions we get asked time and time again is, how do you avoid burnout? And I think that's a big key to avoiding burnout, is that but with both of us, we've got a whole lot of very, very different projects we work on. For me, it's webcomics.com and Comic Lab and After Dark and Evil Inc. and a plethora of commissions and side projects. And for you, you know, you've listed a laundry list of things that are very, very different. Like, Comic Lab is very, very different from the children's book, is very, very different than a space opera, sci-fi. There's a lot of varied pursuits and passions that are reflected there in each list. And I think that's a big part of how we so far have successfully been able to battle burnout, is that, like, sometimes I'm just not feeling it to work on Evil Inc. And when that happens, there's a whole list of other things that needs to be done.
Yeah. Well, like, I bet you this happens. I can speak for you that I bet this happens, where you're like, I just don't feel like drawing an Evil Ink today, but I feel like drawing. I'm in this moment, Brad Geiger. I feel like drawing, but I don't want to draw an Evil Ink today. You know what? I'm going to work on a commission. That'll be fun, new and different and interesting. And then 3 hours later, you're like, wow, that was fun. All right, great. Well, I'm going to work on, let's see, what do I want to work on today? I'll work on, you know, a little bit of a standalone for Patreon drawing. That'll be fun. And you need that because sometimes the creativity engine is raring to go, but the impetus is not there for this or that project. So you switch it to another one, you know? And frankly, Brad, I feel like sometimes we lucked out in not hitting it hugely big with one title.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Do you know what I mean by that?
I think you're right.
I mean, I know it's this sounds disingenuous because it's like, I'm glad I'm not super wealthy, that kind of a statement, you know, but without sounding disingenuous, like, had we got a Garfield level success or a Calvin and Hobbes level success, or it doesn't even matter, like, even a smaller mid-level, you know, Bloom County type thing, we kind of would have been stuck doing that. And that's, I think, why the burnout happens, where at 20 years, you're like, I'm out. You, like, push back from the poker table. I'm out. I'm cashing in my chips.
Yeah. I don't want to draw this cat one more time.
I literally can't take any more orange in my life. No, I'm out. You know, that kind of thing. So for finding a silver lining to our level of success, I am happy that I'm able to dab in four or five different projects rather than being stuck and wedded to one, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great burnout proof recipe for success. So I'll tell you what, let's move on to our next question, because I think there's a lot, that one kind of turned into a bigger topic, and I think this one has the same potential. You want to hear what we've got?
All right. Yeah. Okay, good. Go for it.
So this one comes in from our Patreon backer, Francis, who says, do you ever consume comics or other media with the expressed intention of learning from it for your own artistic purposes? Any tips on analyzing, deconstructing, etc.? I'm talking about actual artistic products, not tutorials, guides, and stuff like that. In other words, do you ever take a look at comics or maybe a movie or a TV show and sit there and deconstruct it? And if so, do you have any advice for Francis on how to do that in their own lives?
So I absolutely do this, and I do it mainly with Drive, and I'll tell you why I don't do it with Sheldon. Because for me, all of the active learning and exploring and seeing how different things are done in comic strips, I did in my teens and 20s. Like, I read more than the average human being would ever read of comic strips when I was in my teens and 20s, you know? I mean, I did two master's degrees in comics, for God's sakes. Like, I did my time, right? I did my time. And so Sheldon, I got it down because I know all the parameters. And it's rare that someone really surprises me with the way that a comic strip could be constructed or a joke told or that kind of thing, right? Like, I know how to do that. But with Drive, I, in my own youth, was not steeped in long-form sci-fi graphic novels. I read sci-fi a fair amount, but I never read graphic novels that were sci-fi. And frankly, that's because they kind of didn't exist when I was growing up, you know? So what I do now is I actively read comics from Image, and specifically Image, because Image, frankly, does it the best in terms of long form story. Like, if you want original storytelling, God bless them. Aside from Ryan North, Marvel is not churning out original stories. They're churning out the 20th iteration of an alcoholic Tony Stark fighting in the Iron Man suit, you know?
Right.
You know what I'm getting at there? It's like, we all know what Batman is going to be, the broad strokes of a Batman story. Like, right. No one's going to be surprised going, what original storytelling? I've never seen this before.
What a surprise that kid, his parents died.
I see why he's trying to help people. He lost his parents to crime, Brad.
Yeah.
This is a good character arc.
They were going through Crime Alley, and it turns out that his parents died.
So his parents died. That's why he became Batman. Anyway, but you get what I'm saying. So Image has incredibly original storytelling. The level of storytelling is par excellence. It's fantastic. The drawing is amazing. So what I do is, when I want to see what's happening in sci-fi graphic novels, I will turn to Image and read Saga, or I'll read Black Science, or I'll read East of West. And I'll see, like, they're very different stories. And frankly, I don't immediately get a much that's helpful for Drive, but I can at least glean what's possible, which in its own way is helpful, you know?
Yeah.
Because you see the parameters of what can be done. And so even if, of the 100 options that you've now been made aware of, even if you choose only one, it was helpful to have been made aware of the 100 options, you know?
Yeah. So now, do you have any advice for Francis in how to deconstruct that? I mean, is there a method you use?
A method I use? I mean, at the undergrad and graduate level, we were always deconstructing works of art, both on how it's built, why it's built the way it's done, what the authorial choices are, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I can't give you a college level course of advice distilled down to it, other than to say, find the people that are doing the best work in the genre or style or medium that you want to work in. Find the best. And then read it a few times and go, how are they doing what they're doing? And maybe more importantly, why are they doing what they're doing? Yes. Why in this chapter did we jump ahead 6 months? Like, ask yourself the authorial choices of, like, why are we seeing this scene only from over the shoulder of this character? What are they trying to impart by that camera angle? Or the color choices here become very dark and somber. Why is that choice being made in this scene?
Yeah.
And if you really start to deconstruct it, and ask very critical questions as you're reading it for the third or fourth time, you'll go, oh, I see what they're doing here. And I see that the seeds that they're planting in terms of plot, or I see the arcs that they're doing in terms of character, why they're doing these choices. Brad, what are your thoughts? What advice would you give in this situation?
For me, I mean, it's kind of weird because it's kind of like trying to tell somebody how to think. Where if I could tell you and put it into really good words, it might not work for the way your brain works because everybody thinks differently. But right. I will say this about that. For me, if I watch a movie, the first time I'm watching a movie, I really can't think about the movie. I'm too busy enjoying it. It's all new. It's all, that was a surprise. There was a plot twist. You know, this happened, that happened. So if I want to deconstruct something, I know going in, I'm going to have to watch it two or three times. Because the first time, I'm not catching anything. I'm just on the surface. The second time I know what's coming up, so I can start to really ask those questions like Dave was asking, not only the how questions, but even more importantly, the why questions. Why is this happening? And it isn't until you get to something like a third and fourth and fifth time that you really start to pick up on all of the little nuances that are found in a really good piece, whether it's a comic or a movie or a TV show. I've seen Glengarry Glen Ross a dozen times, if not more. Like I can't, any time that I see that it's carried on a streaming service, I've got to watch it. And I've watched that movie so many times I can recite it, but still now I've gotten to the point where the plot I've got memorized. And there are certain times like when Alec Baldwin confronts Jack Lemmon at his desk at the very beginning, he leans across the desk and he kind of messes up a bunch of stuff on the desk, among which is a little framed portrait of his daughter. Of Jack Lemmon's daughter, which becomes very pivotal in what makes Jack Lemmon's character motivate. And I didn't notice that the first 10 times I watched it, you know, but the more you watch something like that for me, because I'm easily distracted. I've got to see things several times over and over and over before I can really get past the surface and dive down into the depths of, of what's really happening. What Dave talks about, the why.
Yeah. So I have a couple of thoughts jumping off of this. One is I have never seen Glengarry Glen Ross, and you talk about that movie all the
time. You've never seen Glengarry Glen Ross? Oh my God. Listen, Dave, you need to watch it, and preferably while I'm there with you to guide you through the greatness. It literally, like, if you told me, you know, everybody says the top five movies and Godfather is always number one. Right. Or near the top. And for me, Godfather is without a doubt in the top five. But Glengarry Glen Ross nudges it out of that number one space right into top. Nothing touches Glengarry Glen Ross. It is one of the best movies ever made. And part of what makes it so great is that they gathered a murderer's row of incredible actors and not only good actors, but short of putting William Shatner in the cast, all of these people are amazing at chewing scenery. So you've got Alec Baldwin, Kevin Spacey, the inimitable, the uncomparable Jack Lemmon, Al Pacino. And it just goes on from there. And these actors are put in these scenes where they are these intense emotional scenes full of this incredible language that they're batting about. And it's like watching an opera that's not set to music. It's that level of intense. You've got to watch this movie.
So in a way that just infuriates my film cinephile loving friend there, Fred Schroeder, you could name the top 100 films, Brad, and I haven't seen any of them. I have read.
You've never seen Godfather?
I have read virtually every great novel that's ever been written from my academic life and afterward. But film, to me, like watching the great films, Like, I haven't seen Citizen Kane. I haven't seen Casablanca. I haven't seen Glengarry Glen Ross. I haven't seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I haven't seen, like, you could do a whole row of great films. The Godfather, I haven't seen.
Seen The Godfather?
No.
That's impossible for me to believe.
A lot of movie watching to me is like eating broccoli. Like, I'll do it, but I don't particularly want to. Unless it's sci-fi. I will watch the shittiest sci-fi movie. I have watched Starship Troopers, Brad, which is a terrible movie. It's terrible. I've watched it like 5 times over the course of my life. It's terrible. It's legitimately terrible. I just, you know what it is? We all have the spark of what interests us. And for me, the great films are not what sparks me. So for whatever reason, little fun fact about me, I've never seen like 20 of the top 100 films.
Wow, that's amazing to me. Hey, this must drive Fred crazy.
Oh, it drives him bonkers because I'm like, so what is it about Citizen Kane? Any good? Is there anything happen to it? And there's no way to trigger him more than to do that. But I want to.
That's enough to make a guy like Orson Welles drink.
Oh, Orson Welles would have hated my film watching.
Yeah.
So I see what you did, Brad, but I wasn't ready on the button there. I was not ready, and I feel bad.
Oh, my God. There you go.
The French.
I love that I can go back and forth. All right. So I want to, though, get down to Francis's question, because I want to teach you one great cheat about storytelling that will help you in many different ways, which is, as we've referred to before, we're going to talk for a second about Joseph Campbell and the hero with 1,000 faces, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as you know, and everybody at this point in culture knows, there is the idea of the hero's journey. And there's like a 12-step process of what this hero goes on. And by doing so, by breaking down to its most basic levels, you can see that Hercules' story is the same as Luke Skywalker's story, is the same as Odysseus' story, is the same as Gilgamesh, is the same as all these different stories have the same hero's journey, right? So let's say you're working on a story right now, Francis, and you're like, how can I learn from different people that are working right now? Well, the trick is to not go in and steal from Saga, right? That there's two aliens that, but work backwards and be like, well, how did they get to that? Oh, because it's Romeo and Juliet. That's what Saga is. Saga is Romeo and Juliet. And the crux of that is two lovers that should not be together, could not be together, would not be together in any normal circumstances, that break all the taboos and thereby throw both the societies into a furor because they are together, right? Mm-hmm. Saga is Romeo and Juliet, but just set in sci-fi. And obviously, there's 1,000 other storyline layers, but you get what I'm going with there, Brad. So what I'm saying is, when you want to try to crib from the great stories, you don't steal the surface stuff. That's the stuff that gets you into trouble. What you want to do is break it down to what the story elements are that make it a classic and make it unique, and not unique, that's what I was trying to say, that make it an eternal story. Two lovers that should not be together, a hero off on a journey by himself, whatever the classic story blocks that you want to get to, you break down a story down to the basics of what it is. And then you work your way back up again with your own unique spin from the skeleton. Brad, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's brilliant. And a hero's journey is a great structure to learn. There's also, I want you to check out something that Dan Harmon has done a video on. He's the creator of Rick and Morty, called The Story Circle. And it condenses that and takes some of the like gender roles out of it. You know, like it takes a lot of that that meeting the enchanted woman and stuff out. And it boils it down to 8. And if you learn that, you can start to see that structure, like Dave said, same as Hero's Journey, in a lot of different ways. And once you train yourself to notice that structure, you can do what Dave is talking about and get beyond the surface and get down to the nuts and bolts of what's actually making that narrative spin.
Right. And so when you do that, you'll see that, there are actually story elements from Jason and the Argonauts, you know, however many thousands of years ago. I don't remember how old that story is. 2,500 years old. There are story elements of Jason and the Argonauts that have worked their way into the Watchmen because they've tapped into that skeletonized basic structure of what Jason and the Argonauts went through, and then they applied it to superheroes, you know? And so when you do that, it'll both inform your writing and it'll make it, you'll be tapping into a really larger storytelling tradition that humans have responded to. There's a reason why that story survived, and that, by that I mean Jason, or I should say the Argonauts. The reason why the Argonauts have survived thousands of years and some other crap Greek story from back then didn't survive, and it's because Jason and the Argonauts has a great eternal structure underneath it that that still works today. Yeah, right, Brad?
Absolutely.
Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
So listen, we've got time for another question. Do you want to tackle this one?
All right, so this question comes in from our friend Dorian over at patreon.com/comiclab, and Dorian writes, Brad and Dave, you often talk about writing yourself into a corner, but how often do you kick yourself as you wish you could edit the story 2 chapters ago? And by this, Dorian says, not artistic changes, but making story edits, as if you were finishing a draft of the novel and started to edit in the process. So I think that's actually a great question, Brad.
Brilliant question.
How would you address Dorian's thought there? How often do you kick yourselves as you wish you could go back and edit the story from 2 chapters ago?
More often than I care to share with you. And what it indicates to me is that I need to work further ahead. And it's why I make suggestions all the time when I'm talking to people about doing comics, that they should do exactly that. In fact, I pulled aside somebody that was struggling and sharing their struggles on Twitter and pulled them aside and basically said, all right, the daily deadlines are not working for you. In fact, they're harming you. And what you need to do is I want you to write out the entire script that you've got in mind for this book and outline it first, and then go through and flesh it out and draw and not even draw it yet, but get all of the writing done before you even put pencil to paper in terms of drawing this graphic novel. And what I'm getting at there is that the further ahead you can take that writing process, the more you're going to be able to make connections and realize that you need to go back and change stuff before you actually start drawing it out. The further ahead you can get, the better. And it's the other reason that I've been really banging the drum on this issue of not being beholden to a schedule. Because again, you guys, publishing, web publishing doesn't work like that anymore. Web publishing has become jumping into a stream for people. If you, I took the last 2 weeks off on Evil Inc. because I just had to get other stuff done. I didn't make an announcement. By the way, that's the dumbest thing you can do. Don't announce that you're going to miss your schedule. Your readers aren't even noticing it. They're awash in content. The only way they're going to notice it is if you call attention to it, and then you're calling attention to a negative,
right?
So don't be beholden to a schedule. Only put that comic out when it's ready, and take extra time when you're in the writing process so that you can get as far ahead as you possibly can, so that you can go back and make these connections. It especially if you're working on something that maybe doesn't have a whole lot of traction yet, or if it isn't, like for me, I've got to kind of keep this stuff going because it's my central job now. I've got to keep doing this. If you're in the run up to that, you've got an advantage in that you can kind of sit back and let this thing gestate a little bit. You can let it mature. You can do all kinds of things that that you really should be taking advantage of. But the worst thing you can do is to start be the slave to a schedule and get yourself nice and far ahead. And this question is exactly why. Because when you start getting further and further behind and you're doing this on the fly, as much as Dave and I have certain things planned out, as sure as we've got an outline, I guarantee you there are aspects that we both want to be further ahead, and we both end up kind of hitting our heads on the desk saying, oh God, I wish I had thought of that. And there's only so much you can do going back and retconning and redoing a panel here and panel there that hasn't gone out in a book yet. It causes big problems. and so, yeah, you should be writing as far ahead as you possibly can. Do you agree, Dave?
I do. A part of it, though, that in a different angle from what Brad was talking about, which I agree with.
Yeah.
But I also think you have to come to peace with, if you're doing long form storytelling over a long period of time, which we can all agree is different from finishing a novel and turning it over to an editor. And then there's a back and forth for another 6 to 12 months. Right. So if you're telling a long form storyline over a long period of time, and there's no editorial process in there, a little bit, you have to come to peace with the process of, well, this is a choice I made 2 years ago, 3 years ago, eight years ago.
Yeah, that's true.
And now I just have to make it work. And frankly, see it as an artistic challenge. Like, well, I wish that I would have done X, but I did Y. But now that I've done Y, how can I make this work? How can I make this fun? Oh, I see. Here's a fun solution. And part of it, it becomes puzzle pieces from different puzzles that you're putting together to make a new image, you know, and that's, boy, that's a terrible image. but what I'm getting at there is that you've made a choice in the past, and part of it is when you accept that as part of the process, you are not paralyzing present you by fearing the choices that you're going to hurt future you with right now. And you're also accepting that the choices that past you made are okay and are workable and you'll figure it out. You know, it's basically you have to be forgiving of yourself in the process. Now, that being said, there are two or three times in Drive over the, I don't know, 500 page, 600 page story that it is so far, that I go, ah, darn it, I wish somewhere in the first 100 pages I had said XYZ, right? Or, I wish I would have established that this character came from here or did this thing or this part of the story point was mentioned earlier. But, like, for example, right now in Drive, I have an alien species that I we're starting to introduce, right? And there have been a few pieces of Imperial propaganda and posters and stuff that have shown, you know, quote, all the aliens of the Empire. And, like, they're working together, like, you know, going forward, that kind of propaganda, World War II propaganda, right? But these new aliens that I need to introduce for the story point weren't in that poster. So people are like, what is this? Is this being shoehorned in? And so the way that I'm working it in from a story perspective is that, I drop a few background hints of their existence for about 30 pages ahead of time from when they make their first appearance, right? So you haven't heard of them for the first 470 pages of the story, but then about 30 pages from when they make their appearance, you hear about them obliquely, right? And you're like, wait, what was that name? Who was that? What planet was that? And then what I do from a story perspective, because I had written myself into a corner that they weren't mentioned in previous propaganda posters and stuff like that, is what I do is I say that they've been in open rebellion for the last 3 years against the Empire. And so they're kind of persona non grata with humans. And so there's a reason why they weren't mentioned. And it's because they're basically being open resistance right now. And so as a story point, that has opened up a whole bunch of other possibilities. So the corner that I wrote myself into has actually fostered better story as it's coming to life right now. And so in accepting the fact that I had written myself into a corner and that this couldn't be worked around, I had to make it a positive that these were actually rebellions happening on this planet constantly for the last 3 years. They were killing a bunch of humans. Oh, there's no way humans are going to put them on a propaganda poster, right? That's saying, like, we're all in this together, that kind of a spirit. So it actually became a fun story point of, like, oh, the reason why they're not on these posters is because they're openly being rebellious assholes. And so that's why they're not on there. What I'm getting at is, and Brad, I'm sure, has a bunch of story points that he could point to the same way, is that having written yourself into the corner, you accept and are forgiving of past Dave and what he wrote. And then you say, now, how can present Dave work on it and build on it and make it happen? And then also, you have to be forgiving of present Dave that, am I going to make some mistake, quote unquote, that future Dave has to deal with? 100%. And that's true with Brad, too. Present Brad is somehow going to screw future Brad. But both present, past, and future Brad just have to be forgiving of the process and just say, well, it is what it is. We're going to have fun in the process, and we're going to do the best we can in our storytelling as we go.
Yeah. Well, and that all ties into having kind of an underlying optimism to your creative process in that, yes, you know, like you can certainly say, okay, it's a good idea to get as far ahead as possible. But realistically, you're only going to get so far ahead, and over time.
Yeah, to Brad's point, he's got to get the kids to school, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, over time, you are going to fall a little bit behind, and then when things happen, you've got to have that mindset that Dave is talking about, and say, okay, this isn't so much of a problem as it is another creative challenge, and the whole reason I got into comics was to be creative, so time to roll up my sleeves and get busy. And I think a lot of it, like so many things in this, so much of this comes down to your creative attitude. Like, how are you going to look at this? If you look at it like, oh, geez, I screwed up. It's the end of the world. Well, you're going to have a really hard time with this because those things happen constantly. Instead, if you're taking a look at it like Dave is talking about, like, okay, this is another creative challenge, you're going to have a lot better time and you're going to enjoy yourself more.
Yeah. Yeah. It's basically that idea, you know, that phrase, Brad, the Socratic ideal. Like if there was a Socratic ideal about how you would create it, it wouldn't be this way. But
it is
what it is. And so you start as a given, the fact that it's a long process. Past you has given present and future you gifts. You can accept them kindly and happily and forgivingly and work with them. Or you can be like, damn it, past me. You really screwed us. And then, well, how does that help anything? You know, that doesn't help you in the present. It doesn't help you in the future. And frankly, not only does it not help you, it actually stints and halts your creativity for today that you're giving to future Brad. You know, future Brad is getting shittier stuff because you're angry at past Brad, and you know, and you're not being forgiving.
Too many Brads.
There's too many Brads, and they're all angry at each other. We need to stop this.
Oh. Always. But I want to build on this a little bit, Dave, because as long as you're talking about drive, we've got a question that came in specifically about drive. And I'm sensing that this would be a good jumping off point for this particular question. So I'm going to read it to you now.
Okay.
This comes in from Patreon backer Cole, who says, my question is for Dave. Since you don't use Instagram to promote your Drive comic, what have you found to be the best way to gain new readers? Is it from an email list, Twitter, word of mouth, etc.? So, Dave, how are you promoting Drive since you're not using Instagram?
Well, Brad, so I live in Los Angeles and you are in Philadelphia, two major metropolitan cities.
Right.
And if you're in New York or Chicago or Toronto or London, you probably know this to be the case too, is that every dense urban area has a lot of laundromats. And there's always like pin boards where you can pin little notes up on the chalkboard, on the board there. And what I do is I just say like, hey, washing your clothes, question mark? How about trying some sci-fi? Drivecomic.com. That's what I do.
And you do the thing at the bottom of the sheet where you put the URL and the like five times like on its side, and then you cut the paper so they can just rip the little thing off at the bottom.
Yeah. And then I put my other flyer up right next to it, like, want to make easy money on real estate? Call Dave.
Using somebody else's money.
Yeah, using somebody else's money. By the way, what an amazing scam pitch is that? Brad, do you want to be rich using someone else's money? Like, what? How desperate are you where you're like, that seems like that's a no-lose opposition. That's fantastic. I'm going to do it.
I can't imagine why anybody wouldn't want to do
that. This seems like a win-win for me. I'm definitely signing up for that. I'm going to take off a little piece of paper on the bottom here. This seems fantastic.
Yeah. While I'm at it, I'll sign up for a reverse mortgage. I mean, what would be better than to have a reverse mortgage? I buy the house and you send me checks. This is great.
So, Brad, you say it's called multi-level marketing, huh? This is interesting. I'm going to try it out. I feel like, by the way, Brad, have you tried about the healing power of almonds? Can I sell you some cream, Brad?
Yeah, because I keep going and I ask my French chef to give me the healing powers of a ham and cheese, and he keeps giving me the healing power of almonds.
All right, so let me ask, let me actually answer the question now that I've been spicy.
So the laundromat thing was a ruse. I should not have been taking notes.
Yeah, no, the reason why I mentioned in the laundromat is I have always been amazed at certain physical points in our day-to-day life that have these message boards, and it's like, who is actively looking on this message board or on this light pole or telephone pole that they're like looking for information? Anyway, so how does Drive gain new members? I have lucked out, Cole, in that most of it has been word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
I also have lucked out in that not lucked out, but it worked out that I had built an audience of size with Sheldon over the first 10 to 15 years, such that when I launched Drive, I already had tens of thousands of people I could turn to and go, hey, you like the nerd jokes in Sheldon? Want to try a sci-fi strip? And a percentage of them went, yeah, I do want to try that.
Yeah.
So that was helpful. And then frankly, I have done sci-fi conventions. I have passed out Drive flyers. I have done... back in the day when I thought it might be worthwhile, then good dear God, it's not. I tried advertising on like Facebook and or Google. Boy, never do that. What a waste of money. And then I have kept a consistent ad for Drive up on SheldonComics.com. But I think, Brad, it has largely been word of mouth, and I would like to think good storytelling that gets it passed around.
Uh-huh.
But how about you, Brad? How do you spread the word about Evil Inc.? What do you do?
Well, I do. For me, I concentrate an awful lot on social media, and we've talked about this an awful lot. But I think the crux of the question is, if you're not using social media, what are the other options that are working? And I think what it comes down to is, again, doing a good comic and then making it possible for your readers to share that comic in a multitude of different ways. In other words, even though Dave doesn't use Instagram, I'm assuming that there's a way that somebody can go to today's Drive comic and share it on Twitter, for example, or put it up on Facebook or send it in an email and all of those different ways. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. And I see that on Twitter all the time. Not so much on Instagram, but Twitter all the time. People saying like, hey, this page installment of Drive is representative of why you should be reading Drive. And so whenever that happens, every once in a while, it's someone with 100, 200, 300 readers. But every once in a while, it'll be like 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 readers. You're like, oh, all right, that helps. You know, that brought in one or two new readers. That'll work.
But no matter how big their readership is, it's a good excuse for you to take that heartfelt endorsement and retweet it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now it's going out to your back, you know, your following, which is much bigger, and it carries so much more weight because it isn't you saying it, it's somebody else saying it.
Yeah, and lest it sound like I don't do any social media for Drive, every couple of months, which is not a lot, I will say like, hey, gang on Twitter, I honestly think that Drive is the best work I've ever done in comics, and I really think you should check it out. And I will tweet some version of that. And then I obviously tweet that, hey, Patreon, the new page is up. And then, hey, Drive is up on the site there, and I'll share the page. So I do share it on social media, Brad. There's probably 3 to 4 tweets a week on Drive.
Yeah.
But it's just what I was getting at in my earlier comment about Instagram and Drive and Twitter and Drive is that a long form story is not eminently shareable. It's not in the way that Sheldon is super shareable and will get passed around to 200,000 people, of which I'll get one new reader. But Drive will get passed around to 100, of which I'll get one new reader. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like the numbers are different because the 100 people that like sci-fi get it and one of them will sign up, or versus Sheldon, where 100,000, 200,000 people will see one of my better comics and I'll still get one new reader, you know? So long story short, Brad, all of this is to say that am I still actively looking for new ways to promote and share Drive? Absolutely. I wish there was a way that I could share a long form story in a very easily passed along way And if anybody has suggestions, listen, I'm all ears and I'm happy to learn.
Yeah.
Because I genuinely, genuinely think that Drive is the best stuff I've ever made. And I love this story. And I think on my deathbed, I'm going to be really proud of it. And I know that a lot of people from different kind of backgrounds like the story because it's got a mix of serious story and really goofy, fun characters and a lot of humor and heart and a lot of adventure to it. So it's got everything mm-hmm. that I like. But all I can do, Brad, and I think thankfully so far it's been enough, all I can do is make it the story the best I can, and the word of mouth gets passed along on its own. And it's a very different strategy yeah. from how I do Sheldon, which is to actively promote it 9 ways to Sunday and get it shared around everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's my buttoned up answer. It's not as satisfying as you might think, but that's my answer. It's just produce Drive as best I can.
I'm just happy to hear that you do sci-fi conventions.
Oh, Brad, I will pop you in the teeth.
Because you want to succeed, don't you?
You don't. I mean, you don't want to fail at sci-fi, right? You don't want to fail at sci-fi. Oh, my God.
You know what else you should do? You should be listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been the always delightful Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my friend Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media. And of course, this week and the next 7 weeks are brought to you by the good folks at Wacom, Wacom, WACOM.com for Intuos and Cintiq products that are amazing.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So we're going to say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab.